University Forum is a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University, which brings speakers and performers to the campus throughout the semester to lecture on a variety of topics. The opinions expressed by the speakers do not necessarily represent the opinions of Nebraska Wesleyan University or of this station. Today, University Forum presents the Nebraska State Poet, Bill Clefcorn. The title of his address and his 17th book of poetry is Drinking the Tin Cup Dry. An English professor at Nebraska Wesleyan University, Clefcorn's activities have not gone unfounded. He was named state poet in 1982 by then-Governor Charles Thone. In 1987 alone, he won a Governor's Art Award from the Nebraska Arts Council and the Nebraska Library Association's Mary Sandoz Award for his efforts in promoting poetry. Most of the situations and characters Clefcorn brings to life are autobiographical. Many are taken from his childhood during the Depression in tiny Attica, Kansas. He learned to love the land, and with great perseverance from his high school English teacher, learned to write. Clefcorn didn't begin to write poetry seriously until 1969. "I tried poems in high school, you know, mostly rinky-dinky rhymes," he says. "They were awful. Getting older has helped a bundle." During the past 2 decades, he has published 15 books of poetry and 2 chapbooks. Join us now for Bill Clefcorn, his poetry, and University Forum.
Thanks, Don. Thanks, Kent. That was great. Well, thank you. Is this mic all right? Can you hear? Thank you, Kent. That was a very generous introduction. And thank you, John, for playing that song. Title of this poem is Argyles. Argyles are coming back. Argyles. Sunset is a mellow Picasso dream, purple to aqua, crimson to pink. My gal has new argyles. With a firm hand, I find each argyle pressure point, ending at the ankles. We sit on the porch watching an argyle terrier water my argyle lawn. Then we drive to the center of the rainforest to make us some argyle love. An argyle moon spills its orange into her argyle hair. Not even the argyle rooster next morning can rouse me. Around noon, I find my argyle cat, a goldfinch in the spikes of its claws, curled asleep on the hood of the Fairlane, dreaming Picasso dreams. I'll read a few poems from Where the Visible Sun Is, which, as Kent mentioned, is a new book, and then several poems from Drinking the Tin Cup Dry. The deer. The deer comes to the edge of the river to drink. Its ears straighten suddenly to tell it how harmless I have become. Its breath against the water further softens the early evening. I have moved away from the bank to shadow myself against the bark of a cottonwood for the rest of my life to watch this. And we must have a spring poem on account of its spring. I call this poem Spring. I wrote this after listening to Garrison Keillor talk about the short memory that many Minnesotans have. And it occurred to me that in some respects, some Nebraskans, myself included, have short memories. I have a short memory for some things and a long memory for others. My long memory tends to in the direction of those things that don't matter, and the short memory in the direction of those that do. As, for example, the seasons. I rarely remember last winter. That makes every winter a new winter. Makes every spring a new spring. By analogy, it makes some other things new, too. Spring. Now the season is doing it again. We call it spring. And I thank God for the short memory. Thank God that each time it happens for the first time. It's Wilder's Our Town playing in reverse. Emily up from the grave coming on stage saying, "Hello, tree, tree with your big, white, bursting, beautiful blooms. Hello, blooms. Hello, earth. Earth just last night rained on. Hello, rain, effluvium of rain. Hello, cattle. Cattle with your newborn standing knee-deep in gumbo aromatic in the feedlot slobbering grain. Hello, slobber. Hello, grain." And you beside me, in this audience of two, positioning for the first time ever your hand, my hand. Creation. When she looked at me and said, "Say something from the Bible," I suddenly didn't know anything to say. All that multitude of verses I memorized in Mrs. Heath's class at Sunday school, gone, like the certificates I kept pinned to my bedroom wall for proof. It was her eyes that made me go blank, those night dark eyes you'd love to park the cars of your dreams in. And the midnight hair curled under just so against the moonlight lobes, you'd swap your place in that front row pew in paradise to nibble on. Then all at once one came to mind, and I said, "Turn away from man in whose nostrils is breath, for of what account is he?" "That's not in the Bible, dummy," she said. "And even if it is, I don't believe it." And she took me in her milk-soft arms and kissed me with her wine-sweet lips. And when she finished, I said, Isaiah 2:22. And she kissed me again, and that evening and that early morning were the first day. I turned that poem into a country western love song, but I can't remember how it goes. There's the short memory. Camping on the north bank of the Platte, I wrote this poem with Harvey Potthoff in mind. And the reason he was in mind is that I was with young people out of Camp Augustine, and I don't know anybody younger than Harvey Potthoff. Camping on the north bank of the Platte, for Harvey. Early evening, and the young people are wading the river, becoming bold in its clear, shallow currents, their laughter hanging distinct and immobile in the warm and windless air. They will not be surprised when later the storm blows in, slapping the tents. No more surprised when, just as suddenly, the storm moves on. When night, with its myriad stars, settles over their luminous bodies like a weightless comforter. They are in love with the inevitability of joy. When they sleep the insolent sleep of the stone. O Lord, how the power of the absence of guile might buy and sell this world. Mother, grandfather, who was the first to permit the dream its entrance into the lizard's brain? In our own sweet, partial ways, we are immortal. Three years ago, Eloise and I joined my brother and his wife in London, our first experience abroad. And we went from there to France, spent some time in Paris, not sleeping. And then to Germany for a while. And I thought I would write many poems out of this innocence abroad experience. I wrote two. And I'm going to read half, I guess, of all the poems I wrote out of that experience. It's called the Louvre. We spent one day doing the Louvre and Chartres. Then we had some time, of course, left over for important things. At Chartres, the guide spent a good deal of his time talking about the blueness in the windows. And what he was saying, in a nutshell, was that there is no blue like that blueness anywhere. It cannot be described. And it took him about 15 minutes to describe it. And I wanted to shout to him in French, there is no green like John Deere green either. But my French isn't very good. I know how to say how far is it to the railroad station. And I know how to say, if you don't stop driving so fast, I'll never ride with you again. Neither of which would have done in that circumstance. Anyway, I bought a pocket knife at the Louvre. And it was about $1.50 or something like that. And I believe Eloise chastised me for that, if I remember correctly. All this wonderful art around here, and you buy a pocket knife that was probably made in Belgium. Probably made in Dallas, since they were selling it, you know. But it had one knife and a little corkscrew on it. And later in the evening, I had the last laugh. The Louvre. Today it's the Louvre, yesterday it was Chartres, where the guide, having said that the blues in the windows could not be explained, tried to explain them. And I remember how blue was the bottle of evening in Paris I spent my last dime on. How night after Saturday night, the lobes on my girlfriend's ears drove me crazy. But that was yesterday at Chartres. Today it's the Louvre, where Mona Lisa behind a doubled wall of glass hangs motionless, defying gravity, where the backs of the gleaners bend forever into their harvest, where man and woman recline together as if unashamed, their bodies so immediate I touch mine. Yesterday at Chartres, after the tour and the Gothic singing, I bought a pocket knife with Chartres in gold on the handle, one bright blade and a corkscrew. All up and down my left index finger, I have scars to prove my love of pocket knives. How the dullest among them can go in a blink to the bone. How my girlfriend held the bloody bandage near her lips as if to kiss it. But that was yesterday at Chartres. Today it's the Louvre, where I stand with so many others, my wife beside me. All of us wild to create ourselves with the stroke of whatever brush, so that, created, we might begin the formulation of another work. All of us wild to deny what cannot be denied, our ashes given to ashes, our dust to dust. I bought that pocket knife at Chartres, not at the Louvre. And I still have it. So I'll read another pocket knife poem. And it has a cheap title, a cheap name in it, Barlow. Pocket knife named Barlow. It's called For Proof. And if you want to prove that you love somebody, you give them your best pocket knife. Greater love hath no man than that he give his lover his best pocket knife. And it's usually an old one. It's well worn. For proof, I give her my Barlow. She gasps, covering her mouth with one hand, holding the knife in the other. The handle is so worn, you wouldn't know it's a Barlow if you didn't know it. She has eyes that water at the smallest kindness. Hers is the first body I have ever tried to be a cloud above. Hers the first wet face I have ever kissed. All the way home, I lick and lick my lips, mining salt. Under a streetlight, I paused to look down to see my hands searching for something to hold and for something to use to cut with. Under her pillow, night after night, the knife lies unopened, and she tells me how, touching it, she goes to sleep more easily now, I lying awake, ecstatic and bewildered at our mutual loss. This is a poem that's mostly fictional. It maybe should be a short story. It's called "The Day I Peddled My Girlfriend Betty Lou All the Way Around the Paper Route." Because I really didn't have a girl named Betty Lou. And Eloise is here. And and she knows Betty Lou. Yeah. Well, the time frame in this poem is important because I was peddling her around the route about 8 or 10 days before the bomb was dropped on Hiroshima. So the poem starts with passion and ends with war. What else? The day I peddled my girlfriend Betty Lou all the way around the paper route was a warm day in August of 45. Her name warm as the day, her eyes no less dark than her hair, her skin unblemished ivory. How with one swipe of her own deft tongue her red lips reddened. Shall I mention the following, that her teeth were white and immeasurably straight? They were. From where she stood on the cracked sidewalk in front of the drugstore, she called me. Her words, whatever they might have been, wonderfully urgent. I was pumping a purple Hawthorn bike. Its purple faded to a most delicate pastel. Was it the color or my motion astride it that commanded Betty Lou's dark eye? In less time than it takes to remember, she was sitting side saddle on the crossbar, her ivory fingers clutching below the handles as if they meant to stay there for the duration. Clockwise, around the fringes of my small hometown, we circled. Twin sacks on either side of the Hawthorn filled to overflowing with the high black headlines of war. And a week from now, the message of victory, with its sickening undertones, will start its murmur. A-bomb, fallout, half-life, Hiroshima, radiation, ground zero, Nagasaki. Vocabulary sufficient to stun the most highly fortified of lexicons. Betty Lou, meanwhile, wore a pleated skirt green as those leaves on the catalpas, and her tan blouse, for all its cotton, could not entirely flatten the points of her breasts. Clockwise, around the fringes of my small hometown, we circled, Betty Lou's thin legs hanging lovely and lofty from the crossbar, my pumping of the purple Hawthorn bike stirring a breeze to send dark hair flowing into my face, my mouth, the mix of hair and of breath, that union that maybe believers mean when they sing of how beautiful heaven must be. So what do I remember? That the movement clockwise did not indefinitely last. That when I passed the backyard at Bullard's and my buddies at basketball looked up and started to wave but didn't, I did. That trying not to sweat, I felt the moisture coursing the spine like a rivulet. That when I crashed a paper through Ruby Nelson's screen door, Betty Lou's laughter out from the ivory palace of her mouth gave me the strength of more than 100. That I can hear the sound of that laughter yet, eons beyond the lexicon embodying A-bomb, fallout, half-life, Hiroshima, radiation, ground zero, Nagasaki. That the circle we finally finished is never finished. That the burned and wasted bodies of children, though gone, are never gone. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I was on sabbatical a couple of years ago, and each morning I saw my wife off to work. Didn't have to, chose to. And one March day after a wonderfully light, fluffy snowfall, I proposed to her that we go do something rather extravagant. That is, have breakfast at the Hy-Vee diner. So we did. Then she took off for work, and I walked home. absolutely wonderful morning. The snow was still on the trees and bushes. And I thought of our neighbors, Jack and Phyllis Ernst, who within a year of each other died of cancer. So I wrote this poem for them, kind of a postcard that I'm sending them. That's one good thing about writing poems, you can do that. So here it is. After breakfast with my wife at the Hy-Vee Diner. Softly on spring snow, I walk the 12 blocks back home. An early morning sun about to burn its way through a gray overhanging of clouds. Where is the wind? Where are the friends who coughed their last sweet, bitter days into a cauldron sufficient beforehand to the brim? Heavy with flakes hang the limbs of cedar and pine and linden, cardinal on a green-white bough. This is a postcard I would send. My wife drove off to work, where probably just now she is speaking to youngsters of their options, preserving the baby high among them. Meanwhile, softly on spring snow, I walk the 12 blocks back to home. Already on the lilacs, buds not far from bursting. This is a postcard I would send. Flake and cedar and pine and linden, cardinal on a green-white bough. The last poem in this book is has the title of the book in it. It's called Easter Sunday. And it has a character in it that Eloise recognizes, a piano player in our church, a substantial woman who I realized later when I left home had a couple of interesting characteristics as a piano player. She believed it was her mission in life to play the piano louder than the congregation could sing. And I thought that's the way you did it until I later heard other pianists. Her second quirk was that she thought it also her mission to finish about a half note before everybody else. Each hymn a race. When I was a kid, one of the great pleasures of going to church occurred when the service was over and I could leave. Easter Sunday. At the upright piano, Ernestine Trotter sits in close and heavy combat with the choir. She will play louder than the choir can sing or die trying. The minister speaks of that force strong enough to overcome the immovable object. He leans into the pulpit, tipping it forward until somebody ohs. When the juice is passed, I help myself to a double portion. Mother says that for every container, there is the right lid out there somewhere. Yet Ernestine, I am told, will never know a man. I watch her pound the upright in the general direction of oblivion. With each stroke, watch its keyboard rise as if the Savior we are singing about again. When I shake the minister's hand, I shake limp skin. Take the long steps downward, three at a time. In my father's house are only four small rooms. I cannot wait to shed these unnatural clothes. Cannot wait to go outside to breathe where the visible sun is. I had a couple of requests that were not immoral. So I'll do those. Eloise asked me to read this poem called Lake Leba, Early Spring. Lake Leba is north of Lincoln, about 50 miles. And on a clear, calm, balmy evening, sitting outside near the lake, I swear you can hear voices all the way across the lake, even though that's a considerable distance. You know the kind of evening I'm talking about, probably. Lake Liba, early spring. One. Rum in the veins of the cottonwood. And it seemed that way. I mean, you know, if a cottonwood could... Well, you know how cottonwoods shiver like that. And I had the notion that those cottonwoods had been drinking. Probably not. Rum. I mean, rum in the veins of the cottonwood, and 100,000 leaves begin their flickering. Above a blue flatbed of water, cool as the underbelly of a stone, crappie are jumping, flexing themselves like paid performers against a sudden burst of yellow sun. Two. Out of the small wet tombs of our dreams, we have come alive. And along a stretch of granulated beach we gather now, our backs and thighs and bellies taking in the offspring of a generous sun. A south wind rises. The water begins to swell and crest and spill itself again and then again along the sand. We move into the nearest current, skin and sun, wind and sand and water becoming one. The word in the throat of the meadowlark is precise and clear. Oh, nothing short of death, sweet death, sweet death, can keep us from reviving here. Three. Suddenly it is so calm, we can hear the quiet crashing of an orange sun gone down. We breathe out. We breathe in. The western star on schedule explodes its film. And the water begins to settle. A vast and tireless mother, it rocks the moon. Four. Wine in the bloodstream of the campfire, and the sticks and stones of ages let go their passion. We raise our glasses to touch each other's hands. Shadows on a soft, shifting screen project the sound as, from across the water, other human voices reach us. And once again, once yet again, in mutual awe and love, we drown. And this second request of a poem called Walking the Campus. And of course, that would be Wesleyan's campus. Which is one fine campus to walk if you haven't walked it lately. If you haven't sniffed the blooms on the snowdrift flowering crab apples, then you ain't lived. Walking the Campus. Under a full summer moon, the hackberry rises beyond itself, each leaf a hand flat against a dense conglomeration of Nebraska stars. Old Main stands steady as a good heart's beat, its red brick stout with ivy, its doors a beckoning to each of the four immense directions. I am walking the campus, studying the books of bur oak and of pine, around me the sticks and the cornerstones of ages. Far down the wood chip path, the path keeps going. Remember the face beside you during all those eons in chemistry? Fire is what you felt when something turned your eye to meet that other eye. Now water cools the mind, furrows the earth, from which emerge the blossom and the stem to sanctify the air. Always there is a country to be away from. Always just beyond the outstretched arm, a lesson ripe to be learned. Always a bed of olive or of wheat straw to return to. Beside a young persimmon, I pause to inhale the evening. A woman holding the hand of a small boy comes up the path. She is talking quietly, explaining everything, each word distinct, each syllable a piling up of proof that life is the act of paying close attention. When I say hello, the boy giggles. I am at the very edge one more gift, and I'll break like a gathering of long-gone giddy friends into 1,000 songs. And you feel like that sometimes, don't you? Eons of chemistry. How long is an eon of chemistry? 10 minutes. Or less. Well, the first book I read from, Where the Visible Sun Is, I dedicated to our grandchildren, Michelle, William, Kylie Ann, Nicole, Anna, Jamie Lynn, and Big Nate. The other book I dedicate to my mother and father, Ralph and Katie Marie, and I'll end with 3 or 4 poems from this book. Wendell Berry was on our campus several years ago. He's a poet, a novelist, writer of short stories, an essayist, an environmentalist. And this poem is for and after him. It's called The Mad Farmer Shuts Himself Inside His Silo to Sing Away the Storm. I have the notion that Berry is not going to stop talking about environmental issues until they're cleared up. And he's going to live long enough to do that if he has to live to be 150. The mad farmer shuts himself inside his silo to sing away the storm. Because the silo is round, each note is round, each note eternity in a nutshell. And knowing this, the mad farmer knows also that his song can never be lost, never exhausted, never indefinitely contained, that the notes will circle and circle until the storm relents, until the door left open permits them freedom. And they will go then, inevitable as seed, to the four great corners of the universe, there to put themselves together over and over, becoming over and over the song that now, at the height of the storm, the mad farmer, hat in his hand, stands singing, O la and la and earth and water and wind, sunlight and shadow, la and la and hands deep into the soil and work and love. And the greatest of these is work and love and hands, la and la, and the immaculate equation of know-how and concern, until the silo spins with the mad farmer's song, until the storm with its thunder and lightning joins in, law and crack and rumble, and knowing these and the fathers and the mothers and the children of these, the mad farmer, hat yet dripping in his hand, invents a final verse, releasing each word with its attendant note, whole as faith, into the space that waits to be more than itself when the storm relents and the sun does its own savage work and the harvest, behold, is in. Drove back to Kansas a while back to watch a wedding. Eloise couldn't go, and our older daughter, Terry's husband, couldn't go. So Terry and I went and took with us her daughter, who at the time was 2. And it was her daughter's first adventure into Kansas. And I know two is awfully early to do that to a child. I like what Kent Harris says about Oklahoma. He says, every time I cross into Oklahoma, I have this sudden urge to steal something. I don't have that urge when I cross into Kansas. But when I grew up in Kansas, and the place you grow up in does have a hold on you of sorts. Anyway, we had to educate Kylie about Kansas. It's an outdoor wedding, real nice setting, nice day. And the ceremony was taking place over here, and Terry was holding Kylie over here, trying to keep her more or less quiet. And I was sitting roughly here. So with my left ear, I could hear the ceremony. And with my right ear, I could hear Kylie. And it was enough, almost, to make the wedding interesting. Driving back to Kansas to watch a wedding, In the back seat, my granddaughter, almost two, would learn the vocabulary of Kansas. Rock and chalk and jayhawk. High sky, I tell her, for losing your deepest thought in. And space enough for barley and wheat and burial, not to mention breathing. East of Salina, crossing the Smoky Hill, we speak of salt and of cottonwood, my granddaughter saying again and again more than she knows. Later in the park, watching the wedding, I will hear her voice, so beautifully out of sync, rehearsing the marriage of sound to sense and to nonsense. Her mother, my daughter, standing to one side, holding her. Sunflowers catching the best the full sun has to offer. And what before us is being said is what so many of us, in the face of whatever death would part us, say. Hold hands. Rock and chalk and jayhawk. High sky and space, salt and cottonwood. Repeat after me. I wouldn't mind. I think I'd make a good wedding service. Just say, hold hands. Rock and chalk and jayhawk. High sky and space, salt and cottonwood. And the last admonition, repeat after me. Which is one reason you get married, I guess. I will read two more poems. This one called Lovers. And the last one, the title of this book, Drinking the Tin Cup Dry. Lovers. Eloise and I live on the corner of 63rd and Huntington, and there's a bus stop there. And a bus once in a while stops there. And I was reading, I was sitting in an easy chair reading when I noticed some youngsters near the bus, apparently waiting for the bus. But they were involved in, necking, yeah. And when the bus came, they were kissing and they just waved it on. There'll be another one along in a couple of weeks, you know. About the time they finish with that kiss. And I was reading a book. That's the setting. Lovers. I look out the front room window to see a pair of youngsters holding hands at the bus stop. I run my fingertips along the arms of the recliner, peach fuzz, delicate as memory. And I tell myself that I know how they feel. Touch, synonymous with shiver. Blood, beyond the touch, hot and irreversible. And so it is that they are kissing when the bus arrives, and without parting, they wave it on. In this shy neighborhood, another bus will not be along for an hour. I want to invite them in, give them the universal key to the secret room. The girl in the book I am reading has black hair too, black and straight, and the bold words on the page tell me that in the darkness, her face is a white oval in a framework of stars. When I look up, the lovers are gone. The girl with the oval face invites me in, gives me the universal key to the secret room. When I look up, the lovers, because I say so, have returned. And this last poem, Drinking the Tin Cup Dry, is for my dad, who all his life has worked for somebody else. Even when he owned little businesses, he worked for somebody else. I don't think he ever owned them. I think he was always paying on them. But this poem has to do with him as a hired hand in the harvest field. It's called Drinking the Tin Cup Dry. Tin against the boy's lip, cool water slaking the tongue, and my father, the hired hand, hip deep in wheat in the bed of the unpainted wagon, shoveling. Father, I cannot drink deeply enough to drink this tin cup dry. With each effort, the stubble rotates to become the darkened soil that, having housed the seed, gives rise to another windless day. And you are at it again, sickle and chaff, and the women in their blue bandanas, I among them, the incorrigible, the tag-along, wanting to inhale the world, bringing bread and purple grapes and lunch meat. And you, Father, the hired hand, stopping for nothing, not for sympathy, least of all for hunger, until the last of the kernels from the combine lies dutifully spread. Father, all of this aches to be ancient history. But the tin cup finds its way into my hand at the oddest hour. The party rampant with the thighs of city girls and the tinkling of ice in bourbon, and there is nothing for it but to lift and drink. My face in the cool water, beyond it, you in the wagon bed, up to that place that did its work to place me here, breathing the death of us all in the midst of such plentiful grain. Thank you.
Today's guest on University Forum was Nebraska State Poet Bill Clefcorn. This has been University Forum, a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University. Nebraska Wesleyan is a private undergraduate liberal arts university located in Lincoln, Nebraska. Approximately 1,300 full-time students are enrolled in more than 40 programs at the university.